Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which are at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hey, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
Oh, I'm doing great. Great. Excited about our show tonight.
Well, we're going to have a terrific show. We've got a good friend coming back to talk with us tonight. Before we bring him out, any late breaking news? Anything you need to get off your chest? Tell us about.
I don't guess except that I had some interesting stuff I've been tweeting about the last couple of days. You know, something that's simple but profound I thought was pretty awesome was. How they're using this one group is experimenting with different ways to use sensors, for example, to text people when their houseplants need watering. And I mean it's just a really simple thing, right? Well, think about all the different ways the objects in your house that need maintenance or need to be tended to from time to time communicate with you. It's sort of, in a way, a very low tech way for our surroundings to kind of wake up and start letting us know what's
going on.
I love
that idea. I think that's exciting. I wish they had had that technology a few years ago when I was still hopelessly trying to raise houseplants. I've completely given up now. I think if I'd had that, it might have made a difference. I might have been able to keep a few alive, because that is really a problem. It's like, oh, when did I water that thing? And you look over and it's just this like corpse of a plant. So, it speaks to things that don't decay as fast, but that do start to fall apart without maintenance, that you want to know about and you want to be on top of. And you start planting sensors into those kinds of things. Well, you bring that up, and we have to bring our guest out because this is right up his alley. So I'm just going to bring out our guest. Alex Lightman is an author, entrepreneur, and futurist who has made significant contributions to the adoption of IPv6, 4G wireless broadband, wearable computers, and augmented reality. He has authored several books on technology and society, and his book, Brave New Unwired World, The Digital Big Bang and the Infinite Internet, was the first ever published on the subject of 4G wireless technology, also subject of one of the first ever Speculist interviews I ever did. In the past 3 weeks, Alex has published a new book, Reconciliation, 78 Reasons to End the U.S. Embargo of Cuba, and on October 21st, he received the first Economist Magazine Reader's Award, given for, quote, the innovation that will most radically impact the world over the next decade, 2010 to 2020. Based on 5 months of voting in over 200 countries and a panel of 32 judges, in recognition of his innovation of 4G wireless. Alex, welcome back to Fast Forward Radio.
Thank you. It's fun to be able to talk about 4G with the first person to interview me on the subject.
That's right. We've kind of come full circle here, haven't we?
Yes. But it's fun because it actually proves that you're able to find people who are at the beginning of technology and to get it on record, so then we can look at the predictions that were made and see if they were right or wrong.
Right. Now, before we delve into the Economist Innovation Award and 4G, what do you think of this idea of sensors on houseplants to tell you when to water them?
I think it's great. I think it's part of the Internet of Things, and it's one of those things that the First Nation that got everybody to use sensors in their houseplant actually would have an advantage, because they would have meant they made it cheap, it made it simple, and made it brainless. And any time that you can do that, you have the makings of a mass market globally. So if the innovators do it first and then the early adopters, they create an adjacent possibility for all kind of other stuff. But I also think it's a good place to use IPv6. There are enough IPv6 addresses that you could give one to every plant on Earth and still have plenty left over.
Yeah, you could. Go ahead, Steve.
I was just thinking, you know, the houseplants are just the beginning, too. I mean, at some point, I could just imagine, you know, different organs of our bodies, you know, texting us, you know. The pancreas says, you want to hold off on the cheesecake tonight. You know, you've been carb loading pretty hard lately. I need a little rest.
Well, I gave a talk in 2003 that had three slides about a big fat camera pill that they developed in Israel that you would take that would take a continuous video stream of your whole alimentary tract and through your stomach and your small intestine and large intestine, colon, everything. And then the doctors could review it to see, you know, how everything looked. And, of course, we can have that happen and then send us text messages that tell us if we have colon cancer. That's a very, very valuable text. That would actually be worth $1,000 for a text message to have that.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. That would be well worth it. To have that kind of wire, and it's interesting that those are the kind of I don't know, near term, mid term applications for things like IPv6 that are very real, and that the capabilities are very much coming, and I don't think a lot of people have kind of put together that our houseplants, our bodies, parts of our bodies are all going to be. They're going to be wired. They're going to be as much a part of the internet as our mobile phones have become.
Well, for 97% of human history, counted as the 175,000 years of Homo sapiens sapiens, we were in groups of 30 to 50 or so, maybe in maximum 100 or so, and we had most of us out there foraging or hunting for food. And then we developed agriculture, and we were able to have the sun do a lot of our food creation, our energy creation. And then when we had the Industrial Revolution, we ended up having motors be very expensive, but then we ended up with dozens or hundreds of motors that are powering our homes. And then we're now adding many different subscriptions. And it will be in the future very common for someone to have 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 IP addresses that are dedicated, that are for various information subscriptions or feeds or services.
Wow, that is that's an astounding concept, and not that far away either.
Well, it matters when we have the kind of big bang of adoption of IPv6, and there are these different counters and clocks. It's down to less than the last year of the remaining IPv4 address space, and I've been talking about this for 7 years. And now people are starting to take it very seriously. The FCC, Federal Communications Commission, has a technology advisory council with a lot of people reporting to Tom Wheeler. And that committee started off its meeting recently talking almost entirely for the first part of the meeting about IPv6. And there's pretty much universal agreement that the U.S. government and the FCC needed to get on top of it and promote it.
Well, if we're less than a year away from running out of addresses, I mean, what's going to happen when the IP addresses run out?
Well, there's the secondary market. I testified before Congress in May 2005 about this, and I was able to actually choose the government witnesses and the industry witnesses, working with the chairman, then chairman Tom Davis of Virginia. This is back when the Republicans controlled the House, and I purposely had them invite John Curran from Aaron, because he was going to say that there are plenty of addresses and they were going to last. And the key point in the hearing, remember, we were all sworn in, we have to tell the truth. I said, what if General Motors asked you for 50 million addresses? Would you give it to them or would you not? And he hemmed and hawed and stuff, And I said, make him, Mr. Chairman, make him answer the question. And he said, no, we wouldn't give it to him. And I said, so for all intents and purposes, if you define supply as being a legitimate customer being able to buy something at any price, we've already run out in 2005, because you have this committee of people who can hold their noses up and say, nah, your request for a block of IPv4 address is denied. It's not a worthy enough cause. And so we've stretched it by just playing little games like this, or by having people voluntarily surrender their blocks of addresses, which they can't really be compelled to do. They can just be sort of embarrassed into doing. But there are 4.2 billion, approximately 4.2, 4.3 billion addresses. 2 to the 32nd power is about 4.3 billion.
Mm-hmm.
Scientists have about 300 million of those for testing. The U.S. government had about a billion. I got the DOD to admit that it had 700 million IPv4 addresses. And so the rest of the U.S. government had about 300 million. All the universities and corporations combined in the U.S. had about a billion. And that left 2 billion for the other 95% of the world's population. So you can't even have one address per person. But in China, where they claim to have 1.35 billion people, but the real population is 1.75 billion, they only had 80 million addresses from IPv4. So they actually were constrained in a whole lot of ways in how they would build their networks. And this is part of their motivation for pushing for IPv6, because with IPv6, it's 2 to the 128th power, which is 3.4 times 10 to the 38th, or 340 trillion, 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 which might be the biggest number you've ever had on this program.
Well, it's right up there. I got to say, that's a big number. What's the cutover? Does the current infrastructure support IPv6? If I type an IPv6 address into my browser, will it take me someplace, or is this, everything
it's
has to
been,
be rebuilt from the ground up? Or
it's been part. It's been put in. It's one of those things. It's like the metric system. It's like asking me if the metric system is around in the United States. How would you answer that question?
Yes and no. It's around.
Right.
I mean,
we
have it in
IPv6.
Places. Yeah.
It's in places, but the thing is about the metric system is where you have kilometer on a road where there's a metric system, you don't actually have some thuggy or burglar or somebody jump out from behind a sign and get you and then be able to melt off into nothingness. There are attacks that you can make from IPv6 into IPv4 space that you can't really defend against properly unless you yourself are knowledgeable and equipped. And all your systems are configured to handle IPv6. Like, it's part of every router, and you may not be using it, but or at least every router that's been made, let's say, in the last 8 years or so. But it can be turned on without your knowing it, and your network can be accessed without your necessarily knowing it. So it's actually a worst of all worlds. There's a book called How to Steal a Continent, and in it, it's filled with hacks that are explicitly done through IPv6. On people who don't really know that they have IPv6.
Wow. So, interesting set of opportunities and risks there. But I think a real urgency that we start making the move to it. The idea of running out of IP addresses is just kind of scary.
Well, I can tell you that you can, even if you know a little bit about IPv6, you can see where things are fake. For instance, any telco that claims to have 4G. That doesn't give you your own static IPv6 address, doesn't
mm-hmm.
really have 4G. You're not going to be able to get 20 megabits per second, which to me is what is the number for 4G. That's the magic number. That's the right number. It's not one megabit per second, and it's not the ITU's silly, absurd brain cancer accelerating 100 megabits to 1 gigabit per second. I mean, how long is a battery going to last in an iPhone form factor? If you're, if you have everybody doing stuff like that, downloading continuously, all these high definition videos, trying to do that over the AT&T network, it's not going to happen. But if you have IPv6 addresses, you're going to have much better quality of service, and there's just so many benefits to it that I would just contend flat out that 4G globally can't happen without IPv6, and I don't know of any telco in America that has featured IPv6 addresses being given to its customers as part of its plan.
Alex, big numbers are sometimes hard to get our head around. So let me just ask the question this way. If we adopt IPv6, are we going to, a few years down the road, run into the same problem of running out of Internet addresses with the new system?
No, we don't, because if you look at world population statistics, there are almost none that show human population going above 10 billion people. So I don't know of any projections. Now, I had a really interesting debate. I have one of the 100 most influential Facebook networks as measured by greater.facebook.com. You know, it looks at the number of people you know and how many times they post. So I can get some pretty cool discussions going. And one of the interesting ones I had about a month ago was the ultimate carrying capacity of the Earth. And some people say that it's, 500 million people, that's sustainable. And others, I think Michael Anisimov has said, who's also a futurist, I'm sure you've had him in your program.
Yeah, we know Michael.
Yeah, I think he said it's closer to 96 billion people. But the fact is that the models that I've seen, like Club of Rome, which did their models with the Donella Meadows and Jay Forrester at the Systems Dynamics Group, show population going to about 9 billion and then collapsing to 1 or 2 billion within a few generations. So we're going to experience either a voluntary or an involuntary cessation of population growth long before we run out of IPv6 addresses. This I promise.
Okay.
Well, that's... I'm not sure how reassuring that was, actually. I'm glad we're not going to run out of addresses, though. I hate to think about the population.
Oh, you'll run out of oil. You'll run out of uranium. You'll run out of natural gas long before you run out of IPv6 addresses. So George Gilder talks about relative scarcities and abundances. Mm-hmm. So it's very odd that we have all these businesses based on the Internet, and the Internet is responsible for bringing in over $500 billion into the federal treasury. And yet we're dealing with this relative scarcity of IPv4 addresses. It's an indication of our muddled thinking and lack of intelligence as a society. It's an example of what Rebecca Costa in her book The Watchman's Rattle talks about, the super memes that are leading us towards extinction.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what. I want to come back to the what the internet brings into the government and what it could be costing us that we're not capitalizing on certain opportunities. You and I talked about that the other night, and I want to come back to that in a few minutes. But before we do, why don't we go ahead and let's talk about the Economist's Innovation Awards. If you could give us a little bit of background on what those were, and I know there was a particular category, the Reader's Award, that is particularly important to our discussion tonight, but just generally, what are the Economist's Innovation Awards, and what's the Reader Award, and how did you come to be part of all this?
The Economist, according to the LA Times, has the best brand, global magazine brand, both online and offline, of any magazine. About 20% of its readers are in the UK. About half of the readers are in the US, but the rest of them are spread across 200 countries. 1.4 million print issues are put out each week, and they're read by three people. So it has a readership of the print edition of 4.2 million people a week. They have annual innovation awards that are across the board. They're not just technology innovation, like because we're high-tech people and science-oriented people, we might think that that's the only place innovation really happens. But they include political awards and financial innovation, et cetera. And they had, Steve Jobs won an award, and the guys who founded PayPal, co-founded PayPal, Max Levchin and Peter Thiel, won an award. This year, for the very first time, probably because it's 2010 and because crowdsourcing has become a very cool thing and because Economist is extremely, surprisingly, delightfully web-savvy, they decided to crowdsource the big question, which is what innovation will most impact the world over the next decade. And they got 4,000 suggestions from 200 countries. They had a panel of 32 judges that boiled that down into 7 technologies, which we could talk about, or rather 6 technologies and 1 social innovation, 1 social/financial innovation. And then they said, okay, who gets the credit? And I was fortunate enough that the inventor of the mobile phone, Marty Cooper, who I knew when I was writing my book on 4G, was on the panel. I'm sure he had something to say about it. But they said that if 4G wins, we're going to give the award to you on behalf of 4G. And then I actually knew 4G would win because it was the only one of all these innovations that included wireless, included the internet, included broadband. And there's just no way. I mean, we can go over the other technologies, but there's no way that all the other six combined would have a bigger impact on the world. And because it was such a big audience, 200 countries, and because it was across 5 months, that I thought the wisdom of crowds would have time to come to full flower. And so I went there fully expecting to win, and I did.
Well, congratulations. I think it's very cool that this is the winning category, because I have to tell you that when I look at this list from the eyes not of the speculist, because obviously I'm going to gravitate to 4G networks because, you know, I've known you for years, but when I look at this list and think, what is the average person going to think if they read through this list of the short list that the judges came up with?
Well, to be fair, I think that if they read the Economist magazine, we keep in mind this is the Reader's Award, and I'm going to guess that the vast majority of people who voted are one of those regular readers, and the Economist magazine has covered every one of these technologies or every one of these innovations extensively in the magazine in some cases for years. So it is actually a fair thing, and people who read The Economist are damn well informed.
Yeah, I don't mean to imply it wasn't fair. I'm just kind of perusing the list from the standpoint of, you know, what grabs your attention and says, this is the big innovation coming in a few years, and I would have expected, you know, speaking not as myself but as someone just looking at the list, 4G networks maybe to come in like second to last. Okay, the one I would have thought would have been last would have been randomized trials of aid and development schemes. Just because you hear that and you go, why is that even on the list? So let's talk through each of the runners up and briefly tell me, you know, why you think it's an important innovation, and why you think 4G was more important than that. We'll start with that one, randomized trials of aid and development schemes. What the heck does that mean anyway?
Well, remember, this is an audience of people in 200 countries, and I think that the judges wanted to make sure that people in Africa, you know, in China, India, developing countries, who, after all, are the majority of people in the world, had something that was for them as well. And it wasn't just a rich person's list. And, you know, many people in the world live based on the kindness of strangers. And so that's why I think that was there. However, I don't think you would get the vote for people because I don't see it as an authentic innovation. And that's my problem with another one of the things on the list as well. Is it really an innovation? Well, I would say overall that if you look back at time, you have innovation. But also even within Kiva.org or the Grameen Bank or microloans, microcredit, that you have a randomized test of aid right there. And you have, you know, Grameen Bank is now a multi-billion dollar enterprise. And so you can look and see what kinds of aid have helped people the best and which had the best repayment rate. It's almost pretending we don't have data mining capabilities to have that on the list.
Right. Okay. How about the next one? Now, this is my inner fanboy leaps all over this one when I read private space launch services. That must have been a popular choice.
Well, I like that. That was meant to go to Elon Musk. So I'm proud to say that Alex beats Elon. Somebody put it that way when they showed me their notes from this. And Elon Musk is the model, as you probably know, for Tony Stark, the MIT graduate who's at the center of the two Iron Man movies. So, you know, I like to joke with people that I beat Tony Stark for this award. And private space launch is there legitimately because there will come a point when our – but, you know, let's say transhumanist visions, and I am a transhumanist, I revel in the title, will have gotten their way. And the average, you know, people who are transhumanists, at least who want to extend their lives, will be living to 150 or more. So it's possible people within our lifetime will see a time when more people live off the Earth, more humans in their more or less biped, carbon-based biped form, not uploaded form, not, you know, silicoid form or whatever, are more people live off of Earth than live on it. So in that sense, that's an innovation that really deserves to be the innovation that's the biggest impact, because government's not going to subsidize people going into space, and tourism is just an innovator slash early adopter for space colonization. However, this decade, I don't see more than 100,000 rich people going up. And what will they come back with? They'll come back with pictures of space. I would contend that there's no new information that will come back from those tourist things other than people saying, wow, that was amazing. You know, I mean, what new information is going to be gathered through those space voyages? Maybe, I don't know, a single terabyte of information? The information that's defined by Stuart Brand is the difference that makes a difference. I would argue that that's the difference that makes no difference, that that's the best place to spend $100 billion and have no new information that we could possibly find.
And in fact, if we're making big breakthroughs in space, if space is providing any new horizons, it's via not people going there, but what we're seeing through telescopes and what we're learning about the universe just from satellites. And you know, we did a show on exoplanets just a few weeks ago talking about, you know, how much bigger our galaxy is getting in terms of what we know about it. But I would have to agree that probably not a lot going to be going on with people going into space in the next 10 years. Actually, we were talking before the show started. I did a survey on the Speculist a couple weeks ago, and it was predict the biggest breakthrough in the next 2 decades. And I provided these categories. So there's a little bit of overlap here between this and the Innovation Reader Awards, but mine were much broader categories. And I asked people to provide their breakdown in the blog comments. And the categories were artificial intelligence, energy, genetic research, nanotechnology, space, transportation, and other. And out of about 1,000 people who responded, space finished dead last. And that's, you know, not the next 10 years, that's the next 20 years. I think that the expectation is that if something's going to happen in space, it's not going to happen that quickly, that's farther out. And what you're saying, I think, is the same thing, that what killed that one as a winner was the time frame, not the impact.
Well, can I take the devil's advocate position?
Hey, it's your radio show. Go ahead.
I think I will. I'll just jump in with this. You know, the space program, you know, back in the late 60s and 70s was often defended. It's not just that we're going to the moon to sightsee. The very act of going is helping us make developments, and it wasn't just Teflon and Tang. It was also the integrated circuit that arguably was brought about because of the space program. Couldn't the tourist trade bring about some developments like that?
No. I agree with you and about the early space program, but there's this thing called diminishing marginal returns. And here's why this one doesn't work. If you look at the Boston Consulting Group, they have this formula which says that for any product, every aggregate every doubling of aggregate production volume reduces the marginal cost of production by 10%. And it's another way of looking at the learning curve. The United States government, brace yourselves, the United States government has spent over $1 trillion in launch facilities. The United States government has spent over $1 trillion doing space. And so the odds that we're going to come up with some amazing breakthroughs from the private launch in this decade are small because it's such a tiny fraction of overall spending. Whereas if we're talking about spending on 4G, we're spending on, I'm going to anticipate what we're about to talk with Graphene Electronics, you know, that 99 or 100% of that, or yeah, 99 plus percent of that spending will be done in this decade versus 0.1%. So it's a completely lopsided percentage of total spending on the innovation.
All right, fair enough. What about personal genomics?
Well,
that one sounds pretty huge to me, and I would expect big things happening in the next decade on that one.
Well, my favorite publication is one that I happen to have written quite a bit for, and that's H+ magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have actually been very intimidated by personal genomics because it's very much a celebrity technology within the transhumanist community. Until the co-author with Ray Kurzweil of the books Fantastic Voyage and Transcend, Terry Grossman, who runs a longevity clinic in Colorado, wrote...
Yeah, we've had Terry on the show as well.
Yeah, he wrote a fairly devastating critique and said he was taking it all back, that he used to think it was amazing, but he mathematically, he'd done the math. He's done this with four different times and looked at it, and ultimately, here's his math. 95% of people are born more or less genetically perfect, and those genetic defects, which will impact the most people, there are already tests like Tay-Sachs and others. So in other words, you're only talking about 5% of the people, and then you're looking at the big things within that they're already tested for, so there's not that many things. And let's say that you have a 2% chance or 3% chance of something. What do you do? Do you take a pharmaceutical for that? Do you not go out in the daytime because you might get skin cancer? I mean, in the end, these things become rounding errors. And what he said definitively is that he didn't make any changes in his own treatment of himself based on having not one but four of these tests done. So I would have to say that this is one of those things that would only affect a few tens of millions of people a few times at most over the next decade, and that doesn't compare to something that would touch over a billion people.
Okay, well, fair enough. I wonder, though, now that we're into this list, I'm thinking we should have done a two-hour show tonight, but because these are also interesting, but there must be a handoff. There must be a point where we're looking at personal genomics not from the standpoint of pathology, but from the standpoint of making incremental improvements, where we're looking at not fixing known bugs, but adding new features, right? And
I would contend that if you really want this, and this is where I'm happy to have people go nuts, but I would contend, because Cuba has over 50 treatments, medical treatments, that Americans are not allowed to partake of, including treatments for hepatitis B, hepatitis C, esophageal cancer, et cetera, I would contend that simply lifting the embargo of Cuba would result in greater medical improvements to Americans, price performance, et cetera, than any single medical breakthrough that's going to happen over the next decade. And part of that is because Cuban longevity and other statistics are pretty comparable to America. And by the way, if you go to Cuba and you see how much they smoke and they drink, I mean, as a Californian, I'm horrified at how much sugar that they stuff down their throats, because sugar's, fairly cheap for them. It's amazing that their longevity statistics are anything like ours. However, they spend $200 a person on health care in Cuba. We spend $7,000 per capita in America. And for 65-year-olds, the Cubans spend a little bit more, but not much more. It goes up to $15,000, and it goes kind of exponential from there. So, if you're talking about the fact that America is going to run into a wall of printing money and borrowing money very soon, we're not going to be able to afford the health care that we have now. So the key thing to me is not to add more bells and whistles, but to figure out what can we take away from Cuba and how can we get our health care costs per capita down to a few thousand dollars per person.
Okay, and personal genomics won't get us there. Interestingly, on our speculative survey, we actually had about 300 of the respondents came back with the biggest breakthrough would come in genetic research. So we shall see whether that pans out or not. How about the graphene electronics? What's the what's the big value
friends,
prop there?
The smartest friends, the ones who have these ability to change the world, were saying, oh, I feel really bad for you, because there's no chance you're going to win graphene electronics, because this was up for a Nobel Prize in 2008, and it sort of became the pet rock of Wired.com, and it actually came up again. So it's had the advantage of this hype and this wonderful story that these two guys took some Scotch tape and a piece of graphite, like you would find in a so-called lead pencil, and
right.
They just kept on basically removing layers until they were left with something one atom thick, which is like a two-dimensional object, not three-dimensional, but two-dimensional object. And so they said that was going to win. And the idea of graphene is that it has amazing properties of conductivity, that that supposedly information can flow through it very quickly. But the reality is that graphene, has been around since 2004. They didn't bother to file for patents on stuff. And I talked to the guys who won the Nobel Prize for Physics 3 weeks before the Economist Awards, and people thought that that would push them over the top. But the reality is that the company that is made up of the two Nobel Prize-winning physicists is a four-person company.
Mm.
And so that doesn't have any applications. And, you know, I mean, it takes at least 10, 20, 30 years for some brand new thing for us to, that's a science breakthrough to be widely diffused to the public. So as it turns out, I had access to, I was one of the first two people to see a 200-page, very comprehensive report on graphene, and it said that it would not be a big factor in the market till 2025. So, you know, I think that the voters called it right on that one.
Okay. Well, maybe it had it been a 20-year window, as we had at the Speculist, graphene might have won. Is that fair to say?
No, because 4G would still have a bigger impact over the next 20 years. Because it would reach everybody on the planet. And graphene electronics, really, do we really need our consumer electronics to be faster? Is that what the problem is? Is that why Apple is about to become the most valuable company in the world because it makes the fastest iPods? I mean, we have to get a grip on ourselves and think, wait a minute. There's a term I learned from John Smart, computational closure. There's a point at which, like, maps are detailed enough. I mean, do you need your map to have double the resolution next year and then double the resolution from that? I don't really think so. Do you need your pool to be twice as wide? Do you need to swim twice as fast? Does your car need to drive, you know, accelerate twice as fast to 60 miles an hour? There's a point at which you reach good enough to do things, and I think that the big changes are not going to come from Moore's Law. They're going to come from software and anthropology and human factors and making devices, I wrote a bunch of stuff about this yesterday, empathetic, making empathetic electronics.
Well, and I think
I've got to jump in with playing the devil's advocate again, Alex.
Okay, go, Stephen. What do you got?
Okay, well, all the examples you gave I absolutely agree with. I don't need a car that can go twice as fast as the car I have, and I don't need a house, really, that's twice as big as the house I'm in. But computation is the one thing that more of always seems to be a better idea. You know, it's not just that I need my iPod to play the songs twice as fast. I mean, it'll have more capability, the device in my hand or the computer on my desk.
We're moving towards software as a service. We're moving towards cloud computing. We're moving towards the ability to go and purchase applications and computing power on demand and to have operations that can be done in parallel and don't have to be done in serial. So what is the market for the world's fastest computers? If what you're saying is true, then they should have a huge, huge waiting list. But I remember when SGI bought Cray computers, which at the time were the fastest, and I remember that they had almost no orders because the model, the architecture for computing had shifted. So I don't know that graphene electronics is really going to meet a need that will exist in the mid-20s. I don't think it's going to certainly be more than connectivity and connectivity, interoperability, and adaptability, and the ability for a system to know your mind and know your preferences and be context-aware, location-aware, user-aware, none of which takes all that much computing power. It just takes really, really empathetically designed software.
Yeah, Alex, what I think you're missing is super-fast electronics sounds really cool, okay? That's true.
Yeah, but that's not what they were selling, and that's not an innovation. That's just an evolution. See, the idea of it, I'm going to just say what constitutes innovation. And again, I think the readers called it right, because faster computers is not an innovation that suddenly will change the world in 2010 to 2020.
When you look at it that way, I think that makes a lot of sense. It's almost faster computers is almost a given, right?
We have Moore's Law. Moore's Law should have kept that one out because Moore's Law if you were voting for Moore's Law, well then okay, great. But graphene electronics will not have the monopoly on faster computing by any means.
Okay, how about geoengineering? That one sounds. That one sounds hard to top. We're talking about actually reworking the Earth for the benefit of the climate or to bring about other benefits. Actually remaking the Earth, that's got to be the biggest. That's got to be the one.
No, that's the largest vaporware. it's not even going to be allowed because, first of all, you cannot get every nation in the world to agree and to block off sunlight. You can't agree to get them to change the albedo, the measure of surface reflection of the entire Earth. You know, geoengineering is being done right now. We are warming the planet. And Stephen Chu, our Secretary of Energy, has said we could save something like 2 to 5% of our energy by painting our roofs and our roads white. So, but we're not even doing that. So the odds that we, if we're not even doing it in even one town in America, what the Secretary of Energy says we should do, we're definitely not going to get the agreement of every nation in the world on this. So that's not going to happen.
I was reading an interesting article earlier today. I wish I had the site, the URL for it, Alex, but let me just describe it. I'm sure it's a scheme you've probably heard before. Basically, it's the idea of taking CO2, maybe atmospheric or maybe from a plant that's producing it, and converting it to carbon monoxide to make liquid fuel. Now, obviously, the hope then would be that you would you're not only providing liquid fuel in a world that needs more and more of it, but also you're getting CO2 out of the atmosphere. It's an energy-intense process, but apparently, doable on paper. What about something like that, which actually we do because it makes money, and it happens as a side benefit to take greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere.
So what you're describing, Stephen, is kind of accidental geoengineering.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's kind of what we've been doing all along, right?
Yeah, that's the kind we're pretty good at. What do you think, Alex? Not as an innovation, but as a working to make byproducts of what we do more amenable to the planet.
Well, you just asked me two different questions. If by the latter part of your question, there's a whole new area of practice. It's an art and science called industrial symbiosis, by which you co-locate different kinds of industries so the output of one becomes the input of another. However, if you're asking me specifically about carbon monoxide, you do realize carbon monoxide is also a greenhouse gas, and it's highly lethal to humans, and it's how people try to kill themselves by turning their car on in the garage. So the idea that we would make that a major source of in quantities enough to improve the planet, I'm not going to buy it. I'm going to go with what I've heard from Ray Kurzweil, but what I also known for quite some time. If you look at all the world's energy consumption, you could get 1.5 times that from geothermal. You can get 30 times that from wind. If you got every single, you put a wind turbine every single place, and you broke this Chinese monopoly, which has 97% of all the rare earth metals that you need to make turbines, electric cars, say that's not a problem. But if you look at solar provides 4,000 times the energy that we consume in the world today. And oil is the ancient sunlight. It's basically the bank account savings of 350 million years of sunlight that's all being withdrawn over a 200-year period. So to me, anything that takes us away from our focus on solaring the hell out of the planet is, to me, it's like we don't want to do what's staring us in the face 12 hours or more a day. The sun is, Ed Begley Jr. said this. I thought it was quite funny. He believes in nuclear power, the nuclear power that drives the sun, and there's plenty of power there. And, for me, I would say, hey, if you really think we don't have enough, then let's go put up a real project to do a Dyson sphere and just capture it all so that we get the energy that's on the other side of the sun as well.
Prior to the Dyson sphere, we had Brian Wong on the show a few weeks ago talking about putting domes over cities to capture the heat and make better use of the heat and provide a more amenable climate. But even that, I think, is probably beyond the level of geoengineering we'll see anytime soon. Hey, Stephen, before we leave this, what was the byproduct when you burned those carbon monoxide engines? What did you get out? What came out the other end?
Well, carbon monoxide, of course, is a gas, and I'm not talking like gasoline. It's
odorless gas.
It's something that you breathe to die, right?
Right.
Alex is exactly right about that. But carbon monoxide was converted to other fuels. It was used by the Nazis. Carbon monoxide was used by the Nazis to convert their coal into a liquid fuel to burn in their Panzer tanks when they were running out of liquid fuel during World War II.
So it was serving as more the catalyst to...
Well, it's not more than a catalyst. It's definitely part of the formula.
Oh, okay.
And so you're not burning carbon monoxide as a fuel. That's part of the formula.
Okay. Well, that was pretty dramatic, that the image of big tanks of carbon monoxide. I think I had to side with Alex on being apprehensive about that. But anyway, well, let's move on to something everybody loves, electric cars. Can't believe this one didn't win just on sentimental grounds. Everyone loves electric cars. But let me take a stab at why. Let me see if I can answer why electric cars didn't win. I'll give a couple of reasons. One, not really an innovation. There have been electric cars for at least 100 years.
Bingo.
Okay. I got it on the first guess. I'm also going to say, that's all you really have to say. It's just not that big of a breakthrough now, is it?
But there's more that you can say.
Okay.
And this is really important. Over 50 million internal combustion engines, cars, trucks, were sold last year. Guess how many pure electric cars? Remember, it's not hybrids, it's electric cars. Guess how many of those were sold last year?
I don't know. How many Teslas were made, right? I don't know. Not very many, right?
5,000.
Small number. Wow.
So,
okay.
And if you look at the projections, by 2020, supposedly there'll be 70 million vehicles. The low end is 1% to 2% of those will be electric. The high end is 10%, so that you would have 7 million of them. But if you took 7 million in 2020 and you went and you had an arithmetic increase each year, then you're talking about, 35 million for the whole decade. In a world with 800 million internal combustion engines, replacing 35 million of them with electric vehicles, I'm sorry, but it's not going to be the innovation that has the greatest impact on the world. It will be barely noticed. It's just not getting to enough people.
Right. It's an attention getting thing. People are interested in it, but it really doesn't have the impact. Okay. So it's an
innovation that had its day. You might find it interesting that there were more electric vehicles in the world at 1900 than there were internal combustion engines. There was a period of time in which it was the victor. It was the standard setter champion in New York and Manhattan in the 90s. You could get taxis that were steam-powered, were electric-powered, or internal combustion-powered. This is in the 1890s in Manhattan.
Right.
And, if you're in cities and you didn't mind getting lead acid on your pant leg, then they actually worked. But the reason that it lost is because of two things. There was an explosion of converging technologies around the internal combustion engine that were funded in part by the oil companies, and they just added more and more and more innovations to, internal combustion engine vehicles, better seats, seat belts, windshields, service stations with happy, smiling people who said, hello, Mr. Jones, and it just had so many more affordances around that platform, if you look at a car as a platform for innovation.
So that leads us to 4G networks, finally. We took the long way here, but now... We talked a little about 4G at the beginning, but let's take it back to the beginning and tell us why not only did 4G networks win the 2010 Reader's Award for the innovation most likely with the biggest impact over the 10 years, the next 10 years. Not only did it win that award, but why is it truly the mover and shaker on this list and the big technology that's coming?
Well, impacts can happen in a positive and a negative sense, depending on where you are. Gregory Benford has written almost 30 books, and he told me that one of the ways that you write a science fiction novel is you change one aspect of technology, and then you look at it through the eyes of the people who benefits the most and the person who's most hurt by the technology. So I'll start by the impact that will hurt. Real 4G will cause a complete catastrophic convergence of the telecommunications and computer industries. I predicted this in my book, and I don't think people really understood, and it means that those industries that are based on Moore's Law, and I may seem to contradict myself, but those that are based on Moore's Law, i.e. the computer companies and Intel, are going to win. And those that are just based on what a friend of mine calls the lottery of nations, not the wealth of nations, but the lottery of nations, who just got lucky, like they won a license to have a monopoly on telecom, those people are going to be the losers. as there's this convergence, and then a vast number of people, once this happens, will find ways to not pay for their telecom. So telecom is going to wind up with that growing list of innovations that are not a direct cost to the user, but rather the user's attention pays for it in what I call parallel currencies. The big reason, though, why 4G would win is because 4G, to me, is 20 megabits per second. And I believe by 2020, and this is something you can hold me to, hopefully we'll have a conversation in 10 years, I believe that 6 billion people will be accessing the mobile Internet at 20 megabits per second. And they'll be doing it all day long. And that's something that's going to make us a social superorganism. It's going to turn us into something that I call Terra Sapiens, because Jeremy Rifkin calls it the empathic civilization. We are going to be integrated together and caring about each other more, and it's going to make even 2010 seem like the dark ages when we weren't connected to each other. There's a symbol for one person in Chinese or Japanese, you know, the kanji character, and it's like a man with no arms, where people have arms. We're going to feel like people with no arms as we look back on this isolated era. And that's why it's the technology that will most radically impact the world, because it's going to change us body, mind, heart, and soul.
Wow. Okay. I will not challenge. I think I'm agreeing with you here. When I wrote the survey that we did, that I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, I was actually reflecting on a survey that I had responded to myself. The site ilookforwardto.com had surveyed several of us and asked what we thought was going to be the biggest thing that happens over the next 20 years. And I chose artificial intelligence as my big category, and then down within that I talked about the conversational user interface, another term from I don't know that he invented it, but that I learned from John Smart, the idea of this very tight interaction between human society and machines, between individuals and machines, and this kind of enabling technology for exactly the kind of convergence that you're talking about. But it seems to me that those two answers have a lot to do with each other, that you and I are both talking about the basic infrastructure that has to be in place in order for us to kind of make this next move into really kind of, as you said, the emergence of a new entity, kind of a hybrid of machine and human intelligence, a hybrid of machine and human society that is enabled by us having, on the one hand, the right hardware, which is 4G, and on the other hand, the right software, which would be something like the conversational user interface. Do you think that answer is in line, or is the 4G enabling technology more important?
I think that I like John Smart, and he's been a strong influence on my ideas about the future. But in the conversational user interface will make a big difference, but it will make a difference to the poor, which I'm deeply committed to. I'm one of the few Americans who has been invited to India's conference on IT for the common man. That's what they call the poor. But, you know, the common man is their term of art for it. So it will help the conversational user interface will have a massive impact on the incomes of the poorest people who are illiterate. The illiterate are, in every society, the poorest people. Also, the blind have a 70% unemployment rate in the United States, and they are treated horrifically in other countries. Not every country, like Spain, it's actually one of the better places. It's horrible to be blind, but they have a better funding for their programs in Spain than anywhere else. But what I was listed in Faith Popcorn's Dictionary of the Future for something called the Internet Iceberg Effect. And just like an iceberg is 90% below the surface, what's funny to me when people talk about the future and they talk about the Internet, 90% of the growth of the Internet is not between humans, it's between machines, machine-to-machine communications. And as you reduce the cost of bandwidth, you end up with a very reconfigurable, very agile society where corporations can change their – like I was speaking to some very, very smart, successful people and including one of the best high-tech recruiters in the world and an amazing internet entrepreneur, and they were in solid agreement with each other that the sole basis for competition by 2020, and actually they gave an earlier date, but you wouldn't believe me if I told you, the sole basis for competition is who is the best at agile computing and agile, what I would call agile communications.
So give us that earlier date. We got to know now.
They said by 2015.
Wow. No kidding.
In other words, they see an absolute, like, you know, meteor that killed the dinosaur style event coming with agile computing imminently.
Well, and in your view, 4G would be the enabler of that. Is that right?
I think that 4G will be the kind of connective glue that holds society together and keeps it from falling apart with all of the economic dislocations, because there are too many people doing work that doesn't really add value and they kind of get away with it. But if you go to Crowdflower or you go to these or Odesk or you go to these sites for computer-aided cooperative work and bidding out jobs, you know, you're going to have all this different work that can be queued up and people who have their eBay-style buyer-seller ratings that have it for their labor or giving out jobs and projects, and they'll get their projects done. For instance, my Cuba book, Reconciliation, I have what I think is the coolest cover of any book I know. I mean, I'm looking at it now, and I just think, wow, that's a cool cover. The story behind the cover is that David Orban, who is the project director for the book and a good friend, went to Crowdflower with my instructions. So I had about a paragraph of instructions I'd given to David. David has a five-star buyer or procurer of labor kind of rating on the various sites he uses, and he created a contest. And for $300, we said design the whole book cover, and we had 27 entries. He boiled it down to 8. I put the top 3 that I liked on Facebook, had, I don't know, 20, 30 comments from people, picked the one I wanted, awarded it, and then gave a few more bucks to make a few more, you know, tweaks in the winning design. But for basically $350 plus, you know, David's assistance, I got an amazing cover of a book that I just love and would have been much better than I could have instructed someone to make. I think
well,
that's going to...
You also got some great advertising for the book and developed some interest in the book just by the cover contest you had going, right?
Oh, okay. I hadn't even thought of that.
Yeah.
Side benefit there. That's very cool. Hey, Alex, yeah. You know we're almost out of time. Before we go, can we touch quickly on the when you and I talked the other night, you were talking about how much money the government spent on internet technology and what rate of return that brought them, and the way we're missing out on 4G.
Well,
I don't know if we have enough time
to
cover that or not.
Sure. Yeah, I can cover it succinctly. I'm always amazed at people trying to tell me to vote for one party or the other, who are total, they imagine themselves to be total expert in which party is better, but they don't know which policies are better and which policies are worse. And I would say that the people I respect are very few in politics, but they're people who can do an ROI analysis on major projects for the U.S. I will tell you what my research indicates is the best ROI in U.S. government history, and that was spending $50 million on the Internet to in the early days of the Internet, 100% from the federal government for Larry Roberts' work at ARPA to make ARPANET, which is also called DARPANET, AlohaNet becoming the Internet, TCPIP from Vint Cerf and Bob Kahn, Lynn Kleinrock's work at UCLA. So all that kind of stuff. In 1990, the U.S. government had revenues of $1.1 trillion. In 2000, it had revenues of $2.1 trillion. So the United States was able to increase its revenues. And I'm not talking about a phony baloney measure like GDP, where if there's a car crash, GDP goes up. I mean real-life dollars that can be spent and, you know, and squandered or invested, et cetera. So,
yeah, the actual amount of money coming in, right.
Yeah, so an extra $1 trillion dropped into the U.S. government's hands. And that's pretty much, that's sort of a bottom line for the federal government. Economists at MIT and other places said roughly half of that was due directly or indirectly to the Internet. Now, that's very exciting because that means that the Department of Defense is a profit center. That the, in other words, all the money we spend on DOD, and this is what you were saying earlier about, you know, the money from NASA and the integrated circuit, stuff like that. You're right about that. That really, NASA paid for itself. it actually, NASA's free. There are certain places that are such consistent producers of out-of-the-park, home-run innovation that effectively the agency has paid for itself in perpetuity. It's an annuity, and they should just keep hands off, you know, F off these kind of innovation agencies, because they're where the innovation comes from. So if you look at that $500 billion a year versus that $50 million, that's a 1,000,000% ROI every year. There's nothing like that in history. Now, what makes me kind of exasperated is that I have pointed this out to thousands of people in the U.S. government and said, you got to have the say. Now, the DOD had the say in the Internet, but it walked away like a petulant aging starlet into the sunset and had nothing to do with standards in the Internet for 19 years until 2003, when I grabbed them by the scruff of the neck and brought them back and into IPv6, where they, you know, kind of were, they were like really rusty about what the Internet standards were and what role they should play. There's nothing like this, oh, the DOD is looking 15 years ahead when it came to the Internet. And we didn't do that with IPv6. So China was trying to strangle Japan and Korea into breaking IPv6 and making its own proprietary standard. That's China's obsession. That's why the ITU is all about, oh, 4G is this phony baloney, 100 megabits per second and 1 gigabit per second. It's basically a stalling tactic for China to get enough IP that China can come up with an all-China solution for 4G. It's fake. It's a complete scam. And trust me, you will not see the whole world rolling out where every phone is 100 megabits per second worldwide. The spectrum is not allocated enough to do that. It won't work. So the United States, by not doing IPv6 and China, Japan, Korea, putting about $600-700 million into it, didn't position itself to be a leader in 4G based on IPv6. So all of a sudden, all these benefits that we got out of the IPv4 Internet, and I'll give you one in a second, they won't happen. So this big burst of innovation and jobs that we need to have this decade as the baby boomers start to retire, if you look at baby boomers coming from 1946 to 1964, that's a cohort of 75 million people that start turning 65 next year at the rate for 18 years of 4 million a year. So that's 4 million on average people who would like to retire. They probably won't all be able to, but they can't retire because we don't have this burst of productivity, what I like to call the productivity singularity, which would have come from real 4G as we had a broadband-enabled service export boom. So I'm kind of mad that the U.S. government was so smart but didn't have a mechanism of seeing what it did right so it could do it again.
All they needed to do was replicate their own success. What they had done before with the Internet, they do it again with 4G, and sitting in the middle of a 4G boom. Is that the idea?
And I posted it on Facebook today, an article that I wrote back in 2004 about how to create 10 million jobs by investing $10 billion in IPv6 and how you could create an extra $10 trillion in GDP in the second half of the Bush term, basically the second Bush four-year term. And I'm just so annoyed because I told the government, I testified before Congress, I got 40 federal agencies, I did the transition plan for NATO, and there were 40 countries that said, yeah, good, this makes sense. There was nobody who was saying it was a bad idea, but they just never followed through on adequately funding it. So instead of putting $10 billion in and getting 10 million jobs, we put, I don't know, $1 trillion in bailouts, $500 billion, pick a number, and we have fewer jobs. And this is something that I predicted in 2004. I have it on my Facebook page, the double-edged sword and the section they did, we didn't. And what I basically said, and I'll just wrap up everything now, if we don't lead in IPv6, we can't lead in the Internet. If we don't lead in the Internet, we can't lead in IT. If we don't lead in IT, we can't lead in high technology. If we don't lead in high technology, we will not have an economy that grows fast enough to be exporting and creating all the big jobs that we need to compete with hard-charging countries like China.
Wow. Well, I'll tell you, Stephen, it looks like we've gone over our hour, so I apologize. Well, there's no point in apologizing to live listeners because they're not hearing us anymore, but I'll put a note up on the site. But with that in mind, One last question, Alex, for those listening via archive, which is most of the listeners to the show anyway. How do we get back on track? Can we get the boom back? Is there what needs to happen?
We need to have the federal government step in and say, hey, this 4G thing, we're going to say what the United States government is going to say what's 4G and what's not. We're not going to leave it to the ITU. I mean, since when does the U.S. leave standards to something controlled by China? And we're going to say,
indeed,
you know, we're going to tell T-Mobile and we're going to tell AT&T, we're going to tell all these people doing phony baloney 4G ads that to stop doing it. And then we're going to say, what is real 4G? And we're going to take this seriously, and we're going to actually reallocate the spectrum. And we're going to take spectrum away from the coal miners and the cab drivers and the separate spectrum from each military base and all this stuff that's underutilized, and we're going to expand the ISM band, 900 megahertz, 2.4 gigahertz, 5.7 gigahertz. We're going to expand it by tenfold. We're going to make it 10 times as much spectrum that's available, and we're going to allow devices to have 10 times the wattage to send their signal. And so all of a sudden, then we're going to expand it again and again and again as it's filled up, and so that we don't have 99% of the bandwidth growth occurring in the spectrum ghetto of less than 1% of the spectrum, the available licensable spectrum. And also, there's a process called DEP, direct emulsion plating, that allows us to make devices that will enable us to use the higher frequencies. So we're not really using, you know, 5 gigahertz, 10 gigahertz, 15, 20, 40 gigahertz, but it's possible to make devices through an additive process rather than etching or an acid, you know, like scratching away at taking away materials. By adding to them so that they're stronger and they can deal with these higher frequencies. So those are two of the things. And I could give you a bunch more, but I know our time's up.
Well, the time is up. If somehow we could get the government, if we could get people to understand that spectrum sitting around in odd places like with coal miners and not being used well by taxi drivers and so forth, if you could picture all that spectrum as land that's not being cultivated, right, or it's oil that's not being pumped, right? It's all this value that we're not getting that we could. Maybe they start to understand the urgency.
Which I think is useful here. Those who cannot manage their assets to reflect their true value are inviting someone else to do it for them.
Hmm.
I like that.
Well, on that note, I think we'll have to wrap it. I'm sorry, Stephen. Did you have another question before we go?
No, I was just agreeing. That's a great thought. It's not necessarily a warm thought, but I think it's exactly right.
It's not a happy thought, but it puts us on exactly the right track. Well, Alex, once again, congratulations to you on being selected. I think you've made your case that you absolutely had the winning technology, and we wish you all the best of success. We enjoyed talking with you so much and look forward to having you on again very soon.
Great, and I consider talking with you a milestone in my life and my career. So thank you for being there and being so consistent.
Thank you, Alex. All right, Stephen, what's our music for this evening?
Our music tonight is Part of This by Christopher Bell. This may be the first time we've had a cello player on Fast Forward Radio, but stick with it. It's interesting.
Christopher, I'm sorry, what was the name?
Christopher Bell.
Christopher Bell with Part of This. I'm glad we're continuing to broaden our musical horizons with some cello music. Thank you, Stephen, for putting that together. Thanks once again to our guest, Alex Lightman. To everyone who listened live and got cut off, sorry about that. To all of you listening via MP3, thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We'll be back again Saturday night with part one of The World Transformed, and then again Monday with another dip into the archives, and back next Wednesday night with another live show. So until next time, live to see it.
The hungry clock is ticking down toward the second through the murmur of the office. Romance whispered coarsely through the neutral telephone, smudged with blush. Neutral telephones, tell me all about your latest crush. The microwave is ticking down toward the second through the murmur of the office. Bullshit fermented in sweatshirt. it off the screen. How did I become a part of this? How did I become part of this? No one is convinced a part of this. How did I become? Silent changes over years. Pride never allows to admit my fears. Softened skin and the heavy hair. Prospects falter under vain. How did I become a part of this? How did I become a part of this? No one is convinced a part of this. How did I become?